Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Sam Moores. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. And on the podcast today, we have Ian Tyrrell. Now, he's a pretty interesting chap. He's been in the industry working on cars for decades. And his sort of skew that he does is crazy Italian cars. So he has built up a massive reputation for working on things like Miuras. When I went to visit, there were 5 Miuras in the shop, something like that. Lots of other avenues about some of the things about working on old cars that are different and Italian things, etc., etc., etc. So lots to dive into around that sort of topic. So I hope you enjoy.
Can you tell the audience just like a little bit about sort of who you are and what you do?
Okay. I suppose my day job essentially has been working on unusual, esoteric, and now classic cars for the last 40 years. That's it, really.
And we're sitting here at your base of operations.
Yeah.
With a bunch of some cool cars behind us and plenty more out of shot if you're watching. Where did this all begin? How did you get into working on cars? Is that, did you do anything before that? How's this sort of come about?
Well, I've always been verging on obsessed with cars. I think my parents would have said the first word I ever said was car, and it went downhill from there. Talk about setting your stall up. I've always been interested in sort of esoteric and unusual things, I guess. I worked my way through the education system up to A levels, and my dad had a packaging business. And we had the good fortune to be to have some sort of interesting cars as the friends have or whatever. And he bought me an old Mini for my 16th birthday for £50, which was a day older than me. I started to sort of tear the car apart and look, buy books like the tuning the BMC A series by David Vizard, which let me tell you was a reference tome for such things, managing to get my head around at least 10% of it. But it sort of developed from there, really. Our bank manager at the time, we're going back to an era when bank managers actually were friends, and you know, there was a sort of relationship there. And he had an old Bentley, 1953 Bentley R-Type, and I ended up rebuilding the engine on that for him. And I was sort of 50-50 as to whether to go into car design or not, because I studied technical drawing. I'm sort of a draftsman to a certain extent. And I wasn't quite sure which way to go. And then I got a phone call out of the blue from the person who ran the local Rolls-Royce and Bentley service centre.
Okay.
And he said, you know, you've been over here, you visited, I like what you do, would you consider being a trainee for us? And that was it.
I feel like that's the sort of the reverse of how most of these things come about. Someone's calling you up and saying, hey, will you come and work with us? Had you been doing quite a lot of things sort of meanwhile during this time then?
Not particularly, but as a family, we'd bought a Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud 2, which not... At the time, it was worth about the price of a new Granada, something like that. Mm. And this is a big step for my mum and dad, but we did it. And we had to find some way to have it looked after. So we'd been to this guy two or three times to have work done on the car. And I just developed a bit of a rapport with him, really. And that was it. I got the phone call. And I used to... It was 45 miles away from our home. And I had an Austin Allegro 1500, would you believe? And I did the 90-mile round trip in that car 6 days a week for 2 years. And the car never let me down. Amazing.
That's good going.
I got the amazingly reliable BMC British Leyland car.
So, and what sort of things were you picking up? When you were working somewhere like that at that point in time, are you... You know, you're sort of getting your hand in lots of different types of work on cars and things like that.
Yeah, we did. We did Rolls-Royce and Bentley's Deluxe. You know, 95% of the work was that. So I was working on Silver Clouds, the Mark VI, even pre-war cars, Silver Shadows, and the Silver Spirit was makes me sound very old. But the Silver Spirit was just coming out around that time. But I got to work on other cars as well, BMW 7 Series, Jaguar XJSs we used to do quite a few of. So I was beginning to build up an interest in all sorts of cars. And he, in fairness to him, he said, you know, maybe one day as a sideline I can open an Italian car section and you can start working on nice Italian cars, which is what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Things took a different turn because when I was 21, I actually left and set up on my own in Wallasey, my hometown, doing esoteric cars. And I actually, much to their chagrin, took their service manager with me, who was twice my age, and offered him a job, and he said yes. So he was now doing the 90-mile round trip from
nice,
the other way.
Nice. I like how you've reversed that. So you're working... What sort of pushed you to start your own business?
Well, I found the 90-mile round trip was beginning to lose its appeal.
I can imagine.
And I'd built up a fair knowledge because I spent a lot of money on buying books as well in my misspent youth. And so I was sort of boning up on workshop manuals and all that good stuff. I just felt there was a need. There was nobody in my area, in Wallasey, who was really particularly specialising in working on unusual cars. So I guess I saw a gap in the market, and we did actually get quite busy quite quickly, dare I say it.
That's great. How did you market this?
Just through word of mouth. That was all.
Yeah.
I did... with the odd exception, there was a guy locally who had a photography business, and he had a Ferrari Dino 246, which was quite obviously very rusty and a bit clapped out, but he did actually use it as his everyday car.
Nice.
It seems crazy now, but... and I walked into his office, bold as brass, and said, if I can convince you I know what I'm talking about, will you let me service your Dino? And he said yes, actually. And I left him a card. I'd had some business cards printed up.
Nice.
Let me tell you. And I left him with a business card. He rang me 2 weeks later. And he said, my misfortune is your fortune. My engine has dropped a valve. Would you like to fix it? And the whole, that developed into a sort of 2-year restoration. And the whole car got restored as a result of that. That was my first major restoration project for a customer.
Was that quite a daunting thing to do?
Very much so.
Because I mean, when you're looking at a car like that, had you worked on one before?
Well, when I was 19, I did manage to. I bought a Fiat 130 Coupe. That was my third car. We graduated from the Mini to the Ford Fiesta van, and then a Fiat 130 Coupe, which was tremendously exotic at the time, really, for me as a 19-year-old. very difficult to get insurance on a 3.2-litre car at the age of 19.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that sort of set me off on that trajectory, really. So the Dino was, fortunately, a natural progression on from that, in a way.
And did you do a lot of the work?
Yes.
So whatever, everything, like I guess like metal work, blah, 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 blah.
No, sort of. I have never done body work. I've seen lots of it done. I've subcontracted a lot of it to be done, but I have never done it because I'm quite happy to stick with the mechanical, the oily bits, but the metal work and paint work, I have never picked up a spray gun in my life. And I have no intention of starting now. I'm going through a phase at the moment of quoting Clint Eastwood, but he says in one of the Dirty Harry films, I think it's Magnum Force actually, to be specific, he says, man's got to know his limitations. And that's mine. So,
nice.
Yeah.
And I guess you're picking up, working on these different cars, and you've got all of these. You've started to build a collection of sort of books and things around the time. Have you still got a lot of the books?
Yep. They're out of shop, but they're all over there in the bookcase.
Oh, okay. And are they quite useful now?
Very much so. Very much so.
Because I guess there's this concept going around, you can tell me whether it's true or not, that, you know, as cars are getting older and the people that worked on them in the time are less and less and less of those, it's getting harder. Is it getting harder to work on older cars, or actually is it getting easier because of the internet and things like that?
Well, I think the internet doesn't really cut it with classic cars. They're such a discipline of their own. You can't type in how to own a classic car on Google. You know, you get your 10
you just
bullet
get the response,
points.
Don't.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Uh-oh. Computer says no. But you've got to know what engine oils to use in them. We've had cars in recently, even from, dare I say this, from recognised mark specialists. And they, for instance, put oil in the engine, which is totally inappropriate. It's too thin for that era of engine.
Okay.
So I think the classic car market seems to be, it isn't waning in any way. I think it's worth between £6 and £7 billion to the UK economy. And I don't see it contracting in any way. I think people are, very nicely, I'll be slightly more direct. The people who did work on these cars are sort of dying off, really.
Yeah.
I'm a spring chicken by comparison, at the age of 60. Hopefully I've got a few good years in me yet. But it's becoming increasingly apparent that we are, that there are less and less people who actually know their way around these cars.
Yeah, and I imagine for your sort of German stuff, let's say a Porsche, believe you can get a lot of stuff from Porsche, and they're quite good at still making parts and things.
Yes, I would tend to agree. In fact, one of my customers, I'll try not to be too specific here, is a German gentleman, and he actually advises the Porsche old time department at Stuttgart as to what should be on what particular cars and the fine details, etc. And, they're not quite as infallible as they used to be. And I don't want, I'm being very careful how I put this, but it is a generational thing, I guess. It's a generational thing, simple as that, you know?
Yeah, because I knew that if you're restoring a car, the stuff you've got to get right. But I'd never really been around a car recently or with someone that really, really sort of knew specifically a certain model, a certain mark until quite recently. And someone was walking around a 356 And to me, this car had been restored in the last couple of years and it looked lovely. And I was like, oh, this looks great. And he walked around and he was like, this is the wrong colour. Like, this bit's been painted. This should be bare metal. Blah, 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 blah. All these sorts of things. And I was just like, okay, I believe you. I'm sure this is correct. But I would never spot any of these things. And that in itself is quite difficult because you're like, I think most people want stuff done the sort of period correct way-ish. But then how do you know if the people you're working with know?
Oh, well, this is, I mean, it's, yeah, you're right. I mean, I because I'm an aesthete, I suppose you could call it, because I studied technical drawing and art, I do tend to, like, I can relate to what your guy said when he was looking around the car, yeah. Because I'm unfortunately exactly the same. And I don't mean that in a malicious way, trying to catch people out. It's just a fact. I remember I went to the Windsor Concours a few years ago, and there was a Ferrari 250 GTO on display there, and it had modern plastic wiper blades on the windscreen. And I thought to myself, either it's a non-original car and they're purporting it to be an original GTO, which is unlikely, or number two, somebody's done it as a joke, rather like putting an exploding rat in a drainpipe or something, or number three, they just don't know any better.
Yeah.
They're charged with working on a car that's worth 60, 70 million pounds, and they don't know that it shouldn't have modern plastic wiper blades on it, for example.
Is there a fourth option, in which case the owner is fed up with old wiper blades that don't work properly and has somehow found a modern plastic one that does work?
Well, that doesn't cut it for me. I can tell you why. First of all, how many 250 GTO owners actually drive their car, or more specifically drive them in the rain?
Probably not that many.
No. And secondly, what was my other reason? Wouldn't they change them for the Concours to bring it back to authentic original condition?
You would, wouldn't you?
Sorry, not trying to shoot you down in
flames. No. It's a sort of innate thing in me. When someone says something, I have to think of another option.
Exactly.
Whatever it is, it's almost to a fault. I've got to think of another option, just in case.
Well, absolutely. There's never a straightforward answer to anything, really, is there?
The slight divergence, but since you mentioned 250 GTOs, there was that one at Revival that exploded a little bit. Which has since it's come to my attention that it's a replica rather than an original. Do you have any thoughts on replicas racing and versus originals racing, or any of those above topics at events? Because that was reported as original.
Yeah, I mean, it's the this is the rarefied air of upper echelons in motorsport. And who knows what goes on, actually? I mean, I could probably make my business to find out if I really wanted to, but part of me actually doesn't want to.
Yeah.
Because it's great to see those old cars racing. I say old cars in inverted commas, racing. I suspect increasingly the owners are thinking, hang on a minute, I can get a tool room copy replica built for £350,000 using the identity of some previously knackered old Ferrari from the 1960s. I'll do that. I'll make it look plastic wiper blades, accepting, of course.
Yeah,
make it look like a 250 and go like a 250 GTO, and nobody will know. We'll put that at the Goodwood Revival under a plaque saying 1962 Ferrari 250 GTO. Who's to say? I don't know. But, I mean, it's interesting. They've sort of got caught out by the sounds of it, have they?
Well, I think probably not in reality, because everyone that go, most people that go, just look and go, there's £300 million worth of cars in this race. And then the people that, like, know more go, well, there isn't. Like, there's a lot of million-pound replicas driving around.
Yeah.
And there might be one original, you know, XYZ or whatever. And then actually, then it even splits into the people that are racing. And I think some of the series are quite particular about not allowing replicas. I think it gets quite difficult at a certain point, but they make a point of not allowing it. And then there's others that allow it. And the people that drive in it kind of know that that's the rules, and therefore it kind of is what it is. The sort of, I don't like the headline chasing of, this one was reported by Goodwood as saying a £75 million 250 GTO spun out and set on fire and whatever. And they doubled down on the fact that it was a £75 whatever. And you're like, well, it wasn't. It was still £1 million. Still really expensive. It's still basically a 250 GTO. It's just not one of the, however many there are,
yes,
original ones racing. I think it's tricky. I would personally like them to have a little, like an R or something just on the, at the end, because there are people that do race these cars, and I feel like they should get like a little plus one on their thing for being like, this is original.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very contentious subject, dare I say it. I mean,
it's tricky.
As I say, I don't know who's to know what actually goes on. But I suspect that not all is as it seems, really. But, as I say, they've been caught out with this one car by the sounds of it. I haven't seen the article or whatever.
No, but it's a funny one. And I think ultimately, like, they're cool cars. They're still really expensive. They're just not quite as many. But I wouldn't, if someone had a real car, let's say a 250 short wheelbase or something, and they took the original engine out and put a different engine in to go racing, like, I don't think anyone can really, you're not going to have a go at them for doing that.
Well, no, I mean, I think my surmising, and I have not studied this in any detail, I've just looked at the clip once, I think, but as far as I understand it, it threw a rod through a missed gear change. It looks to me like it threw a rod out the side of the block due to over revving, due to a missed gear change, and the oil caught light on the exhaust manifold. I don't know, but I mean, that's one of the scenarios. You certainly don't want to put a hole in the block in an original GTO engine.
No.
But Ferrari, of course, will supply a new block and stamped for a certain fee.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Nice.
So who's to say, you know, then we get into the extremely clinical world of old Ferrari authenticity and provenance. And I've actually been an expert witness in some pretty high profile legal cases in the past. One of them, Lord Brockett. Don't know whether you remember the Lord Brockett story.
I've met him.
Right.
But yeah, he buried some cars, is that right?
Yeah, he did. Yes. Or chopped them up.
Chopped them up in his garden, and then was it an insurance claim,
yes,
or something like that?
That's right. Yeah. So I worked for General Accident, I think it was, at the time. But yeah, I mean, so all sorts can happen to a car in 60 years.
Yeah.
The whole thing is how many percentage of it is smoke and mirrors? That is the question.
Yeah, and it is actually, I love details. And in whatever I do, like, I mean, we can see here, kind of overkill for the setup for today. But I'm also slightly aware as time goes on that, like, life should be kind of fun, and getting really, really nerdy about tiny details all the time can take away from that. If you become that person that goes, obviously, if something's a replica or completely different, then it's not what it says. But if it's pretty much what it says, but it's missing it's got the wrong bolt on a wheel or something, it's still basically what you're looking at is still what it's meant to be. And it's just not quite right. And actually, the driving experience is going to be great. The owning experience is going to be great. And the more we sort of dive down and nerd out, you can take away from that. Equally, as the money goes up, you probably do have to, you've got to make sure whatever it is you're paying for is what you're paying for.
Well, that, to use a very old expression, there's the rub. that's the bit. What an owner does with a car is entirely up to them. But a car's intrinsic value, it's like a Picasso painting or whatever, you know. It's the details that make the difference. So, you have to start from a baseline of it being 100% right, I guess.
And
do whatever you want after that, really.
Yeah, totally. So you work on a lot of Italian cars.
Yes.
I don't know, in the 25-minute divergence from me mentioning German cars, we've got back to Italian cars. We haven't done a little Ferrari number. Presumably, getting parts, finding out what was done exactly right from factory, all of these sorts of things is quite a bit more interesting and involved than, let's say, some German stuff.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I've reflected on this over the years. One of the German business models that has served them so well is the fact that we think of them as very technology driven. You know, the Mercedes S-Class has for decades been the sort of technological tour de force, first production car with anti-lock brake, with ABS, that, apart from the Jensen FF, but, you know, proper electronic Bosch ABS, which of course is still very much with us. Things like that. We think of the Germans as being technologically right out there, which they are, but they also stick to their core values. And I think that's a very interesting dichotomy, very interesting combination. I mean, British Leyland tried to, you know, invent the wheel and make a 16-piece wheel and whatever else, you know, but they ran themselves ragged pioneering, which was great. And that's the British are a nation of pioneers, and some of it works and some of it doesn't. But the Germans are very, as well as being technologically advanced, are very much into evolution rather than revolution. So you look at a Golf, for example, you know, the VW Golf, the Mark 1 had one of its styling cues was thick C-pillars at the back, between the back window and the rear window. And they've still got that. They've carried that through.
Yeah.
To, what is it, Golf 8 we're on now or something?
Yeah.
So the Germans are very good at sort of
thoughtful evolution.
Considered evolution as well as the technology, whereas the Italians, the British, are a bit more chaotic than that, dare I say it, which sometimes produces something utterly fantastic and other times it doesn't. Probably the exception to that were the original Rolls-Royce and Bentley. They were very much, very conservative. But yeah, there you are. Long-winded answer, I guess.
So what's the majority of your business at the moment? Are you restoring cars, working on cars? What sorts of things?
Well, we have sort of three strands, if you like. We have the full-on long-term project, restoration project. So a car comes in. These days, car transportation at this level is all about covered trailers. So we have a car arrives, may not even run, and we get commissioned to do a total ground-up restoration on the car. So every last part. Then we have the sort of middling jobs, which is a maintenance job. So can you do a service, but can you also maybe, I don't know, restore the woodwork in a Rolls Royce or, you know, whatever, bit of paint work. And the third one is purely and simply servicing and tuning and out again. So they're the three main strands, yeah.
And when someone sends you a car for a restoration, and it turns up, you've got quite a few Muras around. Let's say a Mura turns up. Do you have an idea of what I'm going to say general, but I presume there is no general, like full restoration of a Mura roughly costs between these two bands, and then you say that to the customer, or do you go, we're just going to get going and then you'll get a bunch of bills?
We've got it a bit more we've got it a bit more tuned than that. Pardon the pun. But no, we know it's, you know, we give people a price, and if we can, more often than not, we stick to it. We're not in the business of saying, oh, now we've stripped it, it's an extra 15%.
Yeah.
Of course, that can happen in extreme cases, but I try to avoid that. I'd like to think I run a bit of a tighter ship than that after 40 years in the industry. So, yeah, we can normally give people a number.
And do you have, are there certain cars that you're like, we just know that car? I don't mean like I mean a sort of model rather than a particular serial number. Is the Miura is presumably one of those.
You mean in terms of restoring it?
Yeah, and like your sort of specialty of like these particular ones where we've done a ton.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, forgive me, but after 40 years, I never knew from one moment to the next what was coming through the door. That was what really gave me a buzz, you know? Whether it was somebody with a Monteverdi going to phone up and say, oh, you know, I've heard about you. I'd love to bring the car in. Like, yes, yes, yes. I remember the first time I got a Ferrari Daytona in. It was in the 1980s. And the guy rang me. And I mean, I was, you know, I was ever so young and ever so thin. People used to walk past me to go to the older guy who I'd taken with me and say, I'm looking for Ian. It was great. Worked every time.
Nice.
I was the lackey. I was the T-boy, you know. I remember the first time I got a Daytona in, I was so excited because the Daytona was one of my icons, really. And he knew, he knew I had not worked on Daytonas before, but he was prepared to give me a shot,
yeah. You know.
And he said, what's your labour rate? And I said, it's £10 an hour. And he said, oh, that seems a bit cheap. And I said, oh, sorry, that's for ordinary cars. For Ferraris, it's £12 an hour. Oh, that's all right then.
Nice.
But, yeah, I guess it's a buzz seeing different cars come in. And I like that because I've been invested over the years in lots of different makes and models. And, in the 40 years of not knowing what's going to turn up, I would like to think that's probably put me in a reasonable place with different makes and models, really.
Yeah. And I guess that's a great ability to go when something unknown, which must be getting rarer and rarer, comes in. Is there anything... that you're like, I really want one of those to turn up?
Ooh, that's a good question. Ooh.
And why?
Is there anything that still makes me stop and think? That's a super interesting question, actually. I'm just trying to think about that. One thing that has eluded me, and there are obviously, quite rightly, there are people who know far about them than I ever will, is Bugattis. I would
okay.
They've always sort of eluded me. I've never worked on a Bugatti. I'd like to get down a dirt, you know, really get into a Bugatti, but I've never done so. The funny thing is, our claim to fame, one of them here is James, our workshop manager, actually went out with on a date, a few dates with Ettore Bugatti's granddaughter. Yeah.
Nice. When you look back or look at the different sort of marks, are there any things that stand out that one or other did particularly sort of differently or interestingly, and you go, oh no, this particular brand is different because they do this?
Oh, totally. I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, you look at something as mundane as a suspension arm, and you can identify which manufacturers
made it.
Yeah. Mercedes tend to be quite high. I'm giving an example now. They tend to be sort of curved, pressed, very, very obviously highly engineered bits of kit with a particular shape and a particular design language. And you look at for example, a Ferrari suspension arm, and it's bolted up from pieces generally, which is fine, you know.
Yeah.
But that kept the costs down, and because they were making tiny numbers of them comparatively. Yeah. And Rolls-Royce everything tends to be over, completely over-engineered on them. So yeah, each manufacturer does have an interesting and you know a particular way, and that's one of the joys for me over the years. I guess that's because, I mean, let's face it, a lot of mechanics who make it to the age of 60 get very jaded about the motor trade, unquote. And you know, rightly so, because the public are not necessarily understanding sometimes, choosing his words carefully, of how long jugs take or what problems can crop up. One of the joys for me is getting into designers' heads. One of the things that sustained me over there is just think, oh, I wonder how they've done that. Oh, that's really interesting, how they've gone about that. Mm. And why is that suspension arm that shape? What's their philosophy?
Yeah.
Et cetera. So, yeah, that's for me is one of the things, one of the joys is actually understanding the philosophy of the different car manufacturers.
Yeah, and so you're saying, Rolls-Royce, you're saying heavily over-engineered stuff. Is there an area of cars you don't work on, or you just kind of, you've sort of...
I suppose I've worked on pre-war cars, vintage and veteran. I've worked on very few of those. Done the odd work on an old Bentley, W.O. Bentley. Worked on a few of those, but I certainly do not specialise in them. But yeah.
And with the, let's say the slightly older Rolls-Royces and stuff like that, do they... Because of this, do they just hold up much better over time, or is that just a where's it being kept, what's it life's it lived sort of situation?
It can actually be counterproductive because Rolls-Royces, if you look at an old Shadow, you know they were horrendously complex when they first came out, probably exceeded only by the Mercedes 600. And obviously, when you leave a car inactive, when you come to restore it, if you've got, one ridiculous thing that they did on the very first Shadows was the front suspension, instead of having coil springs for simplicity, reliability, they had a self-leveling suspension system as well, which had a whole travel of 1 inch, let me tell you. making a whole self-leveling suspension system, supplementary system on top of the coil spring for an inch of wheel travel, you know, of ride height.
Yes.
It's just crazy, really.
Yeah, that's it. It's probably knowing when to stop.
Yeah.
But at the time, it's good marketing material, isn't it, for the new cars you're
exactly
selling.
Provided it works.
I mean, it works, yeah.
Mercedes 600, the comfort hydraulic system, right from the word go, caused them terrible problems, really. Yeah. That's why they never used it on anything else again.
Yeah. I love seeing these weird sort of things that pop up for one car or two, or like a problem we seem to have at the moment, it's getting there, is like hybrid systems on modern cars. There's a whole sort of era of like, I don't know, 5-year band of very expensive cars that have hybrid systems that when you dig into it, all of them have had problems. And all the problems are very expensive. And then we're now starting to see someone like Ferrari come out with a Daytona, as they've called it, the SP3, which is a LaFerrari without the hybrid system.
Yeah, exactly.
For more money, okay.
Yeah.
I can see where this has gone.
Well, I mean, this is one of the... I'm going to have to be careful. I don't get too much into global politics here, but the whole electric car thing, I mean, it takes 250 tons, I've read statistics, of disturbing the Earth's core to make one battery for one electric car.
Possibly. I've been reading a bit about this stuff recently because I want to sort of get more of an understanding of... I'm trying to put myself in the middle of the sort of debate, argument, whatever you want to call it. Because we mine stuff as a human race.
Yeah.
And we have done for a long time.
Absolutely.
And we do a lot at the moment already. So making a car, we mine a lot of stuff. To fuel a car, we dig a lot of stuff up out of the ground. A lot.
Yeah.
So this sort of transition into other materials we're going to have to dig up is going to happen. but we already do a lot of. So it's, I don't think it's necessarily so simple as just going, like lithium, for example. There is a lot of lithium out there. How do we get it?
Mm.
Is all the sort of debates in cobalt and where these places are stored and then refined. It's a complicated situation, but I don't think it's a clear.
Well,
crude
oil is just about the worst possible thing as well, yeah. Isn't it? Really,
like, it's pretty nasty stuff.
Yeah.
If you look at some of these places that are just getting trashed by oil,
yep.
being
yeah.
pulled up and then spillages and whatever.
I agree.
It's not a yeah. It's
and from a health and safety point of view, the concept of people pulling up. Being able to pull a dispenser of extremely flammable liquid out of a piece of machinery and stick it in a car, and,
yeah.
you know, entrusting people to do that on their own without any help. I mean, that would never fly if that was if that came
along. I
mean,
in some
now.
Countries, they don't trust you to do it yourself; they do it for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
the first time I went somewhere where there was someone like helping you was such a weird experience because I just looked at this person like, "What are you doing?" Like. Get away from me. And then like, oh, I'd, blah, 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 blah. Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Put some fuel in.
Well, it's their way of earning an extra living.
Yeah, 100%. And it feels novel because
yes.
it's not normal, but you go to some countries, I've been to some, I think when I was in Dubai, and people pull up, they don't even turn the engine off. They've got the aircon on and they're just like, yeah, fill it up.
Really?
Yeah, I've seen that, which is, kind of mental.
Yes.
I don't think that's like super common, but I've heard this can happen occasionally. So I was having a look through your various things on the interwebs and you now do, and you have quite a pretty successful YouTube channel.
Yeah.
When did you start making videos and why did you start making videos?
Well, the answer to that is very simple. This, like all the best things in life, this caught me by surprise, really. I don't regard myself as techie savvy, you know, with interweb, as you put it, things. But it was down to Harry Metcalf,
yeah.
who has the most brilliant YouTube channel.
Yeah, it's very good.
And rightly is phenomenally successful. And Harry and I... Harry bought his Espada from me about 15, 16 years ago, something like that. And he approached me. We met at a car show and he said, would you like to rebuild the engine on the Espada? And I said, I'd be delighted to do that for you. I was on the Lamborghini Espada 50th tour with him actually in Italy and his car was overheating all the time. So he obviously had problems. We got the car and he said, oh, by the way, I do these YouTube videos. And I saw him talking to camera in Italy once or twice.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what on earth is he doing? And then he said, I've got this YouTube channel. I'd like to do some videos about the engine rebuild. And we ended up doing a series of eight and people seemed to enjoy it. And I have some, dare I say it, I have my other hat is performing arts and theatre. So I can sort of stand in front of a camera and not go. it worked, and people said we'd like to see more of Ian. And I sort of by default, just by accident, fell into. I thought I'll give this a go, and all of a sudden, boom! We had 10 or 20,000 subscribers because they just copied and pasted from Harry's
yeah.
channel, which was great. So
you're obviously doing something right, though, Hake. That doesn't just happen.
Well, it's not for me to say.
Yeah, no, I've been watching some of your videos and like you put a lot of effort into it. You clearly think about them a lot and the content's good. So keep it up for sure. I think it's great.
Thank you. I did have an amusing email from somebody the other day who said, when you use your cue cards, I'd recommend you do this and that and aim the camera this way. And I'm like, thank you. That's very helpful. Just one problem. I don't use cue cards.
Nice. Oh, that's funny. You did a video recently with a boat.
Yes.
A Riva Aquarama Lamborghini. I don't generally... I think I was looking at reavers. I think that's how I came across. I was looking at wooden boats, just trying to find out a bit more about some, and then saw your video and was like, oh, hang on a minute. I thought you did car videos. And can you tell me a little bit about this boat and sort of how that came about?
What on earth is going on there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it was through a mutual friend, really, Olivier Nemesh, who is the probably, I'm going to stick my neck out and say, the world's leading Lamborghini historian. And he knows the Bellini family, principally because of this boat. And he introduced them to me and me to them, and the rest is history. So this was a one-off boat. People think they made several Riva Aquarama Lamborghinis. No, this was, Ferruccio Lamborghini was one of the most wealthy Italian industrialists. He could have anything he wanted in the late 60s, and he decided to have a Riva, and he didn't want the sort of crated American V8s in it. He wanted two of his engines, so that's how it came into being. They strengthened the hull, etc., and the boat was born. And the boat has been restored by some people in Holland who did a lovely job of it. And I visited the Bellina family. We built up a good rapport. And it was agreed that I could do a video on the boat. And they invited me to tune the engines on it for them before an event to balance the carburetors, etc. So that's what I did. And that's how it came. And I thought, this is going to be a sufficiently interesting video that it will be... It'll fit within the channel because it's car. Yeah. It's adapted, marinized car engines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's sufficiently different that I think it'll get people's attention.
And are the engines quite different from, like, how do you have to adapt a car engine to run in a boat? Because water in engines is obviously not a good thing, but how do they sort of adapt them?
Well, the Riva one was a bit of a challenge. Normally what you have is, instead of using water from outside to run through the water jacket in the engine, you have a heat exchanger. So the engine has its own cooling circuit with a radiator, like in the car, except that the radiator...
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Actually mixes with seawater, not air, or yeah, leak water. So the engine is sort of still kept apart, but I think because of propeller torque, with having two props going the same way, they actually reverse the direction of one of the... So one turns clockwise and okay. One turns anti-clockwise. But that actually wasn't a problem because the Miura engine, the engine already turns anti-clockwise.
Oh, okay.
So it was all there, really.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
A question of joining the dots. I'm oversimplifying it massively here, but that's that's the basic concept. Yeah.
It's like you did a very good way of explaining the boat, the history of the boat. And I'm watching this video and going, hang on a minute. I feel like this is a really expensive boat. Like if there's a boat that's going to be worth a lot of money, this boat is going to be worth a lot of money. Do you have any idea what something like that is worth?
Yes, I do.
Can you say?
No.
Okay, fair enough.
It's into seven figures. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I can't say no.
Fair enough. And in the video, you do something which I believe is like one of your things, which is tuning V12 Lamborghini engines and possibly other ones with a bit of pipe.
Yes.
talk me through this process, and can you also talk me through like sort of what you're doing on the mechanical end as well?
Yeah. Well, okay. This is a bit of mischief and quirkiness on my part, really, because there's a scientific way of doing it, and there's an artisan way of doing it, if I can put it that way. So the scientific way of doing it is you use vacuum gauges and what's called a manometer, which is a small handheld device that you stick over the top of the side of a carburetor intake, assuming you can get at it with this thing, and you do it that way. It doesn't require any sort of artisan input. Mm. You just adjust screws and things, but that will give you a scientific result, which doesn't necessarily compensate for any slight anomalies or anything like that.
Okay.
It does, but it doesn't. So as I alluded to earlier, because I'm into music, I actually have been quite into music in my life. I studied double bass for 7 years. I'm a professionally trained singer, etc.
Okay.
It's given me a musical ear, and what I'm listening to with the hose pipe is both quality and quantity of the noise I'm hearing. So the thump as the cylinder pulls the charge in, assuming it's one carburetor per cylinder, that's what I'm listening for compared to the other thumps to make them all equal. And that requires adjusting screws to balance, to let more air in, to balance everything up. And then it's about adjusting the mixture. That bit of it, I can't particularly explain.
Okay.
I don't want to particularly explain. It's quite funny. I had a conversation. I went to California a few months ago, and I had a conversation with a guy there who is, he's got his own repair shop. He says, I use an oscilloscope to tune car engines, so I will look for the wavelength and blah, blah, blah. And I said, that's great. And he was sort of having a go at the way I tuned engines. And I said, that's great, you know, wonderful. He said, so what do you do? I said, well, I listen for the harmonics. And that was it. That was the end of that conversation. He had nothing to say to that whatsoever. And my musical ear has sort of served me, stood me in good stead, really. And I just, for me, it's far more satisfying having an engine running perfectly, if I may say it, super smoothly, through being able to adjust things through intuitive stuff than just sticking a load of pipes on it and whatever.
Sort of dialing it in electronically sort of thing.
Yeah. The results may end up the same more often than not, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just, you can't adjust engines properly with vacuum gauges, no matter how hard you try. And I have tried both. This is not me being dismissive. It's a USP, if you like, these days. I mean, loads of people, there used to be lots of people. When I started, tuning a carburetor, setting up a carburetor engine was quite common, really. Yeah. But not anymore.
Because I know, like, I have a, it's currently for sale, if anyone's listening and wants it, a backdated 911.
Good plug.
NSC. And hopefully it will have sold by the time this goes out, but who knows. and that's on Weber's. And
is it now?
I remember trying to get someone, like the mix wasn't right or whatever. And I was like, okay, can you just sort this out? And like, it's kind of complicated. Okay. And they've adjusted it and it ran correctly. And then I went to somewhere with a completely different altitude and a completely different temperature, and it ran a bit differently and changed the exhausts and stuff. Mm. And you're like, okay, I'm starting to learn that these things are not, it's not quite the same as a modern car where you just dial it in through the ECU, clever and does a lot of stuff and measures a lot of parameters, but there is an art to it. When you're listening in and stuff, is it a similar sort of thing? I play the guitar.
Yep, great.
When you're tuning an instrument, there's a certain like resonance that happens when you get to the frequencies, which obviously you sort of learn over time. But when a guitar goes in tune, it, to my ears, it almost like sings at the point that it's in tune, which is a bit, I can't really explain why that would be the case, because it's just a set of frequencies or something. Do you get a similar sort of thing when you get to this point?
Yeah, I do, yes. I mean, it's very interesting. I'm trying to process and comment on your comments. I mean, it's I guess what you're saying is you know the difference between when it's wrong and when it's right.
I think that's it. I think it's probably years and hours of playing in tune as such.
Yeah.
And because of that, my ears do know. And even, I tune with a tuner and whatnot, but there's just something. And I couldn't tell you if I shut my eyes, that would be the real test, like whether it comes. But the instrument almost seems to come alive just at a certain point when it's just at the right frequency. Right.
Well, one thing to bear in mind is that every note has several sub-notes going on with it. And this is what I'm sort of driving at, really, with the tuning of the carburetors, etc. You have supernumeraries, as they're called, within every note. So harmonics, octaves, whatever it is, either side of it. And maybe that's what you're latching onto as well. If the note is right, the supernumeraries will be right as well.
Yeah.
This is quite a deep subject, actually.
Let's not tangent, but I want to get into this music stuff. So I said this music stuff, it's quite a broad, deep topic, music in general. But you're obviously a fan of music. You play music. Is this something like, you know, that has been going alongside all of the car stuff forever and you've been exploring?
What happened in the 1990s, for fun, I used to play in classical orchestras with the double bass, etc. Never thought of myself as a singer at all. And I, for relaxation and leisure, joined an operatic society locally, etc. And was sort of skulking about, shuffling my feet at the back of the stage in the chorus, you know. And then we all got an opportunity to sing a bit of a song for a charity benefit show, actually. I mean, quite a big theatre. And I sang a portion of a song, and there were a couple of ex-professional singers in the company, and they said, "You should pursue that. You know, you can hold a tune." So I thought, "Oh, great, okay." And one thing led to another, and a friend's stepfather was a music promoter, and blah blah blah, and he'd sung, worked his way around the cabaret circuit in Wales. I mean, cool, to hear me talk about earning a living an interesting way. But he learned how to work a mic and et cetera. So he taught me all this stuff over a period of time. And then, I had a customer at the garage who was a very well-known music producer, does composition for TV and things like that. And we became pally. And in fact, we're still very, very good buddies. And he had a broadcast quality recording studio. He worked 0.2 seconds on music to picture for TV and films and things like that. Very disciplined stuff, you know. And he said to me one day, "Why don't you come into the studio and we'll do some demos?" And I was like, "What?" I was a slithering mess on the floor. This, you know, I was shocked that he would invite the likes of me to do this, really. And so we did. And I got we did a demo, and then I did a concert I started to get work with big bands. My sort of favorite singing style is the Michael Bublé, to give it more Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole, that sort of swing stuff. As a kid, I went to a Sid Lawrence orchestra concert with my mum and dad. My dad knew Sid Lawrence's brother, and we went. And I was completely blown away by the dynamics of big band music. It was just stunning. So I began to sing with big bands in the late 90s, and we sent a demo. Somebody who, blah, 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 friend of a friend of a friend, went over to the US, and before I knew it, it was like that phone call at 19 about working on Rolls Royces. This guy got in touch with me, this American musician who turned out to be Frank Sinatra's bass player. Thank you very much.
Nice.
And he got in touch with me and said, would you like to, I would like to contract you to come over and sing with me in the US.
Oh, wow.
So I was still working on the cars, but I was able to do that. I went for 2 weeks, it turned out. This was in 1998, actually, sorry. And it was amazing. It was completely frightening, but it was completely amazing. And he owned a jazz club in Savannah in Georgia called Hard Hearted Hannah's, which Clint Eastwood used to patronize quite a lot, for example. He made a movie there in Savannah. It was amazing. I met the most amazing people. Have you heard of John Coltrane? Right, his son Ravi was one of the band members.
Okay.
We were all just there for the jazz festival, and I ended up singing live on NBC TV with Ben and his band. In fact, that video is on YouTube.
Is it? I'll go and have a look,
He called me the Frank Sinatra of Europe, Ben. Ben nice. Tucker, his name was, this bass player. That was amazing, you know. So I came back here and the cars took over again. Simple as that. The music sort of worked, but it didn't. And I had a bit of a personal situation in 2000, which took me off track in a good way. It's not appropriate to go into that here, but...
Sure.
I sort of wrote a song in 1999 and started to do some stuff, and then it just all stopped in 2000. But that was how I got into the singing, really.
Wow. I love hearing basically the other stuff people are interested in, because it's very easy when you meet someone. And actually my... not previous guest, but a couple back, we were talking earlier about Rob Wilson. He's a big musician, plays in a band, plays a bass actually. And we had a good chat about that, but it was off recording.
Right.
I don't generally talk about too much other stuff on recording just because it hasn't come up or whatever. But often it's really easy to see people just as the thing that you see them for.
Yeah.
When like everyone has other passions
yeah.
and they're normally possibly quite a lot more interesting than whatever you're there to talk to them about. That's cool. Do you think that brings something, I guess with the tuning and whatnot, to this space, having, you know, that side of you?
Yeah. To go back to what you were saying about, you know, you're tuning your guitar. Once I have tuned an engine, it's a fantastic buzz to be able to take that car out on the road and hear that engine sing, literally.
Yeah.
You know? Everything is perfect on that engine. The whole lot. There are so many adjustments and things. Modern cars, everything's clinical. It's all computer-controlled, which is great. But on classic cars, it's a whole different ballgame. And to have all that working, like a huge symphony of parts and things, is fantastically satisfying for me.
Now I'm going to have in the back of my mind, if I ever end up in an Italian exotic, Countach or something, I'm like, okay, I need to call Ian, get him on the phone. He probably won't be able to stand it. I want to tell you, is this correct? Like, is what I'm hearing, am I getting 10% less than the symphony that I really need? Because some things are out of whack.
Funnily enough, that's very funny you should say that. But I do have people around the world, customers, who actually ask me to diagnose problems on the phone. So I've got this noise.
Okay.
And they put the phone, right, can you just position it another foot away from the engine? I'm not quite getting the right frequencies. And I actually diagnose problems over the phone for them.
Nice.
In Hong Kong or wherever. Yeah.
It's actually amazing how often people dismiss noises.
Mm.
And I'm sure I mentioned this on the podcast before, but I had a little incident with my 911 getting out of my garage. I was reversing and then I heard a noise and I thought, well, there's nothing there, so that can't be anything. And I kept reversing. I ended up trapping a tire in between my car and the door, and it caused a bit of damage. It was not great. It's all fixed now. But if there's a noise that doesn't sound normal, and we all drive, you know, we've all got a car, any car you own will have, make a certain amount of noises most of the time, and then you'll suddenly go, hang on, what's that click? What is that? And then lots of people go, it'll be nothing.
Turn the radio up.
That's
the standard motor trade fix for most of these noises.
You can't hear it when the engine's running full chat. It can't be a problem. Like, no, these are mechanical things. When something changes, it's broken.
Exactly.
It's not getting better.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now, the funny thing is, just to digress on that subject, one interesting thing I've found over the years, that German cars in particular, if they develop a noise like that, sometimes the noise can go away afterwards, and sometimes it can come back. But if you do it, if you get a noise like that in other cars made from other nations, you should be more worried, because they tend to stay. It's something about, because German components are built to a high standard or something, sometimes the noise cannot be quite as much of a death rattle or whatever as it is in other nationalities.
Yeah.
Strangely enough.
That is weird. But then now I'm like, what is it? Yeah, but what is that? It's a funny one. So getting parts and things for some of the builds you're doing, I presume you can't just order them all from what would be called a catalogue, but a website nowadays?
But there are cottage industries that specialise in supplying parts for even specific makes and models. But the problem is, they're not made to the same quality as they were originally. They may not be even made in Europe or the UK or wherever. And we go on a company's website and they're, oh wow, a rotor arm for £1.50. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But you know, it's made out of, you know, recycled chocolate or something. something else unmentionable, you know. And it's just not fit for purpose. And so one of the challenges for us, we do make parts sometimes on a one-off basis. But secondly, is the part we're buying actually any better than the worn out part that was on it already?
Yeah.
That's a real problem, actually.
And how do you sort of work with that?
With difficulty. 99% of the time we get it right. Occasionally we get it wrong because we buy a part in good faith and the car has a running problem, for example. We fit the part and then we discover after throwing and wasting man hours at this thing that it's actually the new part that's contributing to the problem as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
That is annoying.
Yeah.
Especially as you're saying, you do a lot of mechanical parts. Mechanical parts going wrong often send cars off roads.
Yeah, or electrical parts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can you, get stuff 3D printed? Can you use 3D printing?
We do. We're increasingly, yes, I'm officially screaming and shouting coming into the 21st century. and we do get parts 3D printed with fantastic success, actually.
What sort of materials can you 3D print these days?
Well, I am sure, at the risk of maybe sounding a bit too self-deprecating, I'm not exactly sure what you can print these days.
What sort of things are you getting 3D printed?
Rubbers and plastics we do, yeah. I'd like to investigate more of that. Because I think you can 3D print in aluminium and metal and other materials now.
I think you can definitely do some. The sort of trim parts.
Yeah.
That, for me, especially because everything gets thing covered in leather and whatnot, that makes so much sense.
Yes. Yeah. We've had door handles 3D printed, etc. It's a brave new world, all that. It really is. And it does get us out of trouble. It really does, you know?
Yeah, because if presumably, especially the cars you work on, you could get to a point. Are there any, let's say the sort of, I don't know, cars that most people have heard of, are there any parts that you can think of that just nowadays are like, if you lose a fuel pump in a whatever, that's going to take 3 years and a lot of money. Are there any particular standout, you know, parts that just are ridiculous to get hold of?
Oh, yes. We've got a particular old Ferrari here at the moment, and they made very few of these cars to start with. And the like a lot of specialist car manufacturers, Aston Martin, Ferrari, Lamborghini, they all take parts from other makers' parts bins to make them work. So in Ferrari's case at this time, it was Alfa Romeo and Fiat were the biggest ones.
Yeah.
But sometimes the mechanical bits aren't as much of a problem because they tend to engine parts... the manufacturers tended to use engines in more than one make and model. So engine parts are more commonplace, if I can simplify it in that way. But body parts, trim bits, they are the worst. An old car that they made 20 of, and, you know, a third of the car arrives, that's a problem. That's a problem.
And what do you do in that situation?
It's quite often it involves quite a bit of detective work because we have to find out, we have to find out if they did indeed use parts from other makes and models of cars.
Yeah.
That's even, but the other model, make and model of car, they might only have made 500 of, you know. So, I mean, we're up against it again then, you know. That's another layer of difficulty. Yeah, it is difficult. Sometimes... you know, we really struggle with this sort of stuff. We really do. If it's not that easy to make, a little fiddly door lock mechanism or something like that, sometimes these things can just take so much time and energy to sort out, really.
Are owners' clubs useful in this situation for some stuff?
Yes, they are. Yeah, and the flip side of that is, funnily enough, still things come up. I suddenly find body panels for a 1950 something or other, you know, have been languishing in somebody's garage for the last 70 years or something. But, you know, we've got these new old stock bits for sale. It does happen, you know.
Yeah, that's quite cool. And then I guess you get these bits. If it's interior stuff, it's probably all right. But every now and then you probably get stuff and you're like, I mean, it still doesn't fit that great.
Exactly, because sometimes they built the car around it and it wasn't the same as the next one on the production line, you know. Yeah, all these but I mean, it's, I suppose, it's better than doing something boring, really.
Yeah absolutely. Our I keep mentioning the Miura, but it's quite a cool car and there's quite a few here. Are they Miura to Miura, are they quite similar amongst the builds, or is it a lot of like hand work? If you took a door off one, would it fit on another one?
No, absolutely not. No. In that respect, there is a lot of hand fettling. Yeah. A lot of these cars had that because labor was cheap in comparison to now. E-type Jaguars, for example, you can't take a door off an E-type and put it on another one because beyond the back of the door, the C-pillar area, they actually lead-loaded it.
Okay.
Which means they got sticks of lead and they actually melted it with a torch and put it on like putty, basically.
That's good.
And that was how they built up the door pillar.
Oh, wow.
You know, just even as recently as, I was quite surprised because I went round the Bentley factory a few years ago and they were still making the Mulsanne saloon. And they were still lead loading the C-pillars on the Mulsanne in the 21st century.
What? Why would you do that?
Because of the very low production volumes. And also, they probably didn't have access to the very latest computer programs. Yeah. To design body panels that fitted together perfectly. It's hand-built cars. I mean, it's either an advantage or a disadvantage, depending on how you feel about these things. But, hand-built, very much hand-built, unique.
It's quite, and it makes these things, it does add character, whatever character is. There is something characterful about things that aren't quite right. In a precision machine kind of way.
Yes. I agree with you. I think one of the cop-outs for a lot of people with classic cars, particularly people who repair them, oh, they all do that, sir, you know?
Disagree.
They don't.
Mine didn't 3 days ago.
Exactly. You know. You know, I've had some absolute dogs in. I mean, they looked nice. They've been restored, quote unquote, as in people have taken the bits off, painted them and put them back on again. That is not a restoration. You've got to make them work properly as well. And they've been driven absolutely appallingly because people have just sort of thrown them together without actually, you know, knowing what they think they should all drive like that. Yeah. They absolutely should not. That's what, you
so,
know.
Okay then. You get a car in, and it's one of your specialties, is getting cars in that you don't necessarily know too much about or that particular model. How do you know what it's meant to be like? I mean, everything needs to be straight and all that stuff, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
Everything done up.
Well, I mean, I maintain bodywork is not my...
Yeah.
Is not my... You know, I do know about different finishes and what's right and what's not on various makes and models, but mechanically... Well, it's an interesting question because sometimes I've had a car in... and I've driven it, and the gear change hasn't felt all that wonderful on it. And I've thought, oh, that must be what they're like. I've fallen into this trap myself. And then I get another example of that car in, and the gear change is absolutely amazing on it. And I think, oh, well, this is what they should be like.
Yeah.
Well, this is, again, it goes back to our earlier conversation. With people who knew about these things dying off, to be blunt about it, the authority over what is right and what is acceptable and what's not can become hazy, can't it, really?
Yeah, you know? Totally. And with a lot of, especially now, the, let's say, older Ferraris or whatever, they've got expensive now. And, well, they were expensive to start off with. But if you go and test drive a car, one, are you even allowed to test drive it? ? Often you're not. And then if you're going to, well, let's say a Daytona or F40, F50 or something like that, or a Miura, you're not going to be able to back-to-back five cars.
No.
And then go, hang on a minute. Like instruments. You go, you've got to try them all. And you go, well, that's the best one. I can look at all the paperwork and all the stuff and blah, blah, blah. And as long as it is what it says it is, that one just drives a lot better or plays a lot better than the other things. But it's very difficult to do that now.
Mm.
That's why I'm calling you up and I'm saying, listen, does this engine sound right? I normally wrap these up with five questions.
Right. Oops.
You ready?
Ooh.
Oh, no, they're all right. Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
Well, that I can answer fairly easily, actually. Yes, I do. In the 1990s, I was sort of the technical reference for the Ferrari Owners Club of Andalusia in the south of Spain.
Cool.
And we had some very interesting people in that club. And we had some very interesting driving. I mean, there was all sorts of Ferraris. The oldest cars we had there were 328s. And one of those was owned by an ex-Hollywood stunt driver. We had, and I think who I started building a relationship with had a 355 Spider. And we had various cars in between, 456s, etc. Even the Daytona, I remember. And there was a road from Marbella to Ronda in the south of Spain. And it's a fantastic driving road. But boy, it's quite dangerous because it's switchback bends round hillsides with blind corners and no barriers to stop you going over the edge. And we gradually, because of the egos involved and because of the cars and because of the not wanting to lose face, etc., the speed ratcheted up and ratcheted up. And it was basically a road race. You know, so, and the Ronda Road is fantastic. But I mean, it was basically, I dread to think what other road users thought of.
Oh, yeah.
But that, yeah, we had a few fantastic trips up the Ronda Road, and I was driving a 355 Spider, which was almost current at the time.
Nice.
That was good fun.
Yeah, I imagine that was. What other cars you've driven over the years? Are there any standouts that were particularly maybe special?
Well, yeah, I mean, I said this on the video about it at the time, but one car that caught me by surprise was the BMW M1. I never particularly liked the looks of those. And the story was a bit of a mishmash because BMW contracted Ferrari to build them, Lamborghini to build them for them, and then Lamborghini ran off with the money to develop a 4x4, which sort of didn't happen, yeah. But did. So it sort of fudged its way. It was almost destined to fail right from the start, but fail it did not. It became the M1, which was a great car. And the first time I drove one in the 90s, I had one in for work. I thought, this is amazing. Because even the interior is not very inviting. It's 3-series yeah. switchgear and instruments and stuff. And I thought, yeah, it's only a little 3.5 litre straight six, you know, blah, blah, blah. What a great car. Handled fantastically. That was one that caught me by surprise, for sure. That's,
yeah, they're cool. Now, having driven stuff, let's say something like that then, have you driven, let's say, the same or, you know, the same car more recently and felt a difference because of purely this is what they were like when they were new versus this is what they're like now or even restored? Because presumably, I feel like there is a difference between a brand new car off the line whenever it was made and even a freshly restored car now. They're not quite the same.
Yeah. Provided, I mean, it goes back again to how well is it set up, you know? Because
yeah, this is a huge part, I guess.
You know, this is such a big thing with classic cars. You know, to go back to there, they all do that, sir. You know, that noise is normal. No, it most definitely is not. You know, all that business. If they're set up properly, obviously they won't be particularly fast by today's standards. What is the maximum speed on an M1? 160, 165 miles an hour? But they should still feel satisfying to drive, like your 911. You know, yeah. It's not the fastest car on the face of the earth, but it should still provide pleasure and satisfaction. And dare I say it, you know, it's going to be more accessible on a public road.
Totally.
Than a hypercar.
Yeah.
So which one gives you more pleasure, actually, in reality? Once you get the posturing and the price tag and everything else out of the way.
I'm totally leaning towards sort of, I've had all sorts of cars and I'm sort of getting to a point where I'm going for a divide, which is like, I'm not ready for a Rolls Royce, but let's just say Rolls Royce, comfy, luxury, quiet, waft down the motorway, bit of tech, whatever. And then old and kind of, I'm going to say slightly sketchy, not in a mechanical way, but just you feel like you're going fast when you're not going that fast.
Yeah.
And everything in between, I'm kind of like, I'm not that bothered about anymore. Mm. That's just where I am, like, yeah. Right now in my headspace. If you could only drive one car, one sports car for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, dear me. Oh, that's... I've been in the fortunate position over the years where I have had so access to so many cars to be able to drive because I've always had cars needing road testing or something.
Yeah.
And it sounds like some
especially
sort
they're
of...
really interesting.
Well, it sounds like some sort of glib comment, but it's true, actually. To be able to just drill down to one car. Oh, wow. And you said sports car, not any car.
Well, the reason I said sports car is because this question has evolved slightly over time. When ooh. I just said one car for the rest of your life and you can have another car that's like 500 quid or that's probably gone up a bit, maybe £1,000 on the side. So that could take your practical sort of duties out of the way, but you've only really got one nice car.
That's... okay, I'm going to answer that by saying a car I would never normally have chosen, but I can think of I can think it would fit the bill, and that is a 9/11.
And what 9/11?
Oh, too harsh. Now you
I can without like going too far, but I can, okay, what sort of, you know, what era, what what age? Because there's a lot out there.
Oh, dear me. Okay, I would probably say a 993.
Ooh, and which 993?
I've had some good drives in 964s and 993s. So that era, I'm just thinking the modern ones, again, fall into the, they're they're fantastically engineered cars, etc. But, you know, on the one hand, you don't want to, you want a car to be scintillating and captivating, but you don't want it to be able, drowning you with 100 decibels of exhaust noise.
The whole time, yeah.
I mean, it's, I guess because they're a classic, but they're very much a classic air-cooled Porsche, but they're still modern enough to not have too many horrendous...
Yeah, you still got ABS, whatever, all that sort
exactly.
of stuff.
Exactly, yes, yeah.
So like a
Carrera 4S, maybe, yeah. Something like that, yeah.
I think that would be good. That is, as you say, it's quite a nice sort of middle point to go. You've got the classic, in inverted commas, wherever you want to be on the line, sort of experience, air-cooled, etc. Yeah. But you've still got reasonably reliable...
Yeah, you would like to think it would get you...
Engine management system, all this sort of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What should be worth more?
Oof. Well, that is a question people have been asking me for a very long time. Undervalued car... Well, I sort of think 80s and 90s young timers, as the Germans call them, are... I think they're interesting. I mean, a lot of these cars have already flown the coupe, the RS Turbo. I did a Escort RS Turbo Mark 1. I did a video on a while back. They're sort of for a fabulous one, 45,000-50,000. And Sierra Cosworths, of course, go for crazy money as well. So they've sort of flown the coupe, really. But I think there's still some way to go. Quirky 90s cars. Probably I would say Audi Quattro, maybe.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, I think there are enough people who these cars were aspirational for in the 90s who are now a little bit older and who have the cash to buy a toy like that. And they want, you know, to fulfill their schoolboy dreams. I think that would be where I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a good answer. It is. It's the schoolboy dream cars. They're the ones that people are going to want when they've got money.
Absolutely.
Right. Most interesting car to you at the moment? What are you sort of thinking about, looking up, Googling?
Oh. Do you mean in general or cars that I work on?
In general.
In general.
It could include cars you work on or not.
Well, sometimes these things creep up on me, strangely enough. You sort of, okay, you asked the question, I'm going to answer it. But sometimes it can just be, things can just appear in your consciousness that just have absolutely not up until that moment.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, that, strangely enough, a car I was just looking at on the internet a couple of weeks ago was the Peugeot RCZ. Is it? The 260 brake horsepower RCZ.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's either going to be a big disappointment to drive or it's actually going to be quite interesting because they're not expensive at the moment. Right.
And they're cool looking cars.
Yeah, they are. But does the driving experience match the looks, I suppose, really?
I don't know. I don't know. I remember when they came out and I was like, oh, they're cool. I like them. And then I remember looking up, I don't know whether there was an R at that point in time. And they just weren't quick at all. Like,
absolutely.
But relative to, they had the quick car looks.
Yeah.
But I remember just looking up the specs and the engines and was like, nah, no. But I'm no longer interested because they're not as quick as other quick stuff of the time. But yeah, a cool looking car. 5-car garage, unlimited value.
Well, there are two cars I would think of straight away. One is a Miura, and the other one, I happen to love Daytonas very much.
Okay, let's get slightly specific then. What Miura would you have?
Well, it's got to be an SV.
And how is the SV distinguished from the normal one?
Well, the SV, I've been in the fortunate position, again, this goes back to one of my earlier videos, to meet Marcello Gandini at his house, and I drove the Italian Job Miura there.
That's pretty cool.
As well. Talk about ticking your bucket list with about 15 simultaneous.
That's a great reason to make videos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he told me, he walked me around the Miura, and this again, I'm plugging my own videos here horrendously, but it's worth a watch.
Yeah.
And he told me why he styled different bits of the car in different ways.
Okay.
And we're just going to dive very, very deeply into Lamborghini history here. Lamborghini have always had a very close relationship with Pirelli tyres. And the styling of Lamborghini cars, to a certain extent, was limited by the tyre technology of the time.
Okay.
So he styled the Miura with sort of that quite narrow back body. And he was always frustrated, he told me, by the fact that the wheels were set quite deep inside the arches visually. Mm. But also handling-wise, the Miura was capable of a lot more cornering power than it actually had originally. And with the SV, because Pirelli had developed a wider low-profile tyre... The Miura was able to be upgraded to match the tyre technology. And that's why the SV drives better than the other Miuras. So that's nice. There you are. That's the reason. And the SV, of course, has the bigger rear haunches and the wider rear tyres. So there you go. Daytonas. I just love Daytonas. I think they're fantastic cars. I love the... Obviously, these days, there are plenty of cars, 550s, that will see them for dead performance-wise. But I love the character of the engine.
Yeah.
It's just got big lungs, that engine. Just a great engine. And I think the Daytona, for me, is one of the best-looking cars ever built. What else? I'd probably have a Q car, like a Mercedes 6.9 or a Mercedes 6.3.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, don't laugh, a Rolls-Royce Camargue. And because when I was a kid in the 70s, the Camargue came out when I was 12, actually. And it was so unreachable. So utterly inaccessible. Mm. It was the most expensive production car in the world. And to actually be able to meet my heroes, if you like, it's not the most exciting car to drive, but I love them.
Yeah, everything about it, it brings it all back and whatnot. Yeah, yeah, that's cool. Okay, so have you got four? Is that
that's
four?
That's three. Ooh, something off field, like an original Mazda MX-5 maybe.
Fun car, yeah, for sure.
And what would the fifth be? Oof. Well, I don't have anything special as an everyday car. I have high mileage ordinary cars, just a way of getting from A to B. So I don't know what the fifth car would be. Probably something boring like a Merc Estate or something like that.
Yeah. Something, gets the job done.
Exactly.
And then you drive your other cars when you want to have something fun. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for coming over.
Thanks.
Been a pleasure.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.